Radio Cabelli.
Radio Cabelli.
Radio Cabelli.
Radio Cabelli.
Radio Cabelli.
Radio Cabelli.
Cool. Yay, we're back.
We are back indeed.
After a brief summer hiatus. Hooray.
Indeed. Working on our tans, you know, hard work.
Yeah. And also working just generally.
Yeah.
Summer tough.
Yeah.
That's all right. Shall we kick on with the news? What have we got happening?
We have, well, lots of stuff happening. On Monday, of this week, all nine defendants in the second Welling Blood and Honour case were found not guilty of conspiracy to violent disorder. The first trial saw seven guilty verdicts and six defendants sent down. The charge related to a fight between anti-fascists and Blood and Honour skinheads at the Welling train station platform in March 2009. The German Fasch were in the area to attend a neo-Nazi gig at a local pub. Anti-fascists had counter-mobilized. The actual confrontation was brief and really to the point. Two boneheads were attacked by a small group and run along the length of the platform. The minor incident, neither of the Fasch were hospitalized, and neither made a statement. That incident was seized upon by the police and the CPS as a chance to put militant anti-fascism out of action.
Ooh. Mm. In Bristol over the weekend, people heard, saw, participated in, there was the slut walk, which I completely forgot about. Oopsie. But basically, for those that don't know, it's the sort of global phenomenon. This campaign is sort of taking over the world, and I have my suspicions as to why that is. But it's basically a walk against rape, sexual violence, and the blaming of victims. So initially, it was sparked by Canadian policemen who advised students to avoid dressing like sluts in order to avoid being victimised. Bristol on Saturday, there were 150 people, and I've taken this exactly from one of the websites. Many dressed in gloriously suggestive clothes marched through Bristol, then attended talks on College Green. Demonstrators protested victim blaming in rape cases and for the right to dress in a provocative manner, with assumptions being made. I'm going to gather that's supposed to be without assumptions being made about sexual complicity. I didn't go. I'm not totally concerned with the fact that I didn't go, but I suppose for me the whole slut walk thing, like, whilst I support support anything that is against rape and sexual violence, it's the whole, well, they've said it, gloriously suggestive clothes. There's an idea of what a slut is and what a slut isn't, and that's my gripe with it, I guess.
That's a good point, really.
I don't know what to do about it. It's sort of something that's taking over the world, mm-hmm. and it seems like every city in the world has a slut walk, which is attended by people who will have signs, you know, saying, you know, consent, blah, 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 and really positive things, but then there's this idea of, you know, women dress in a certain way and therefore they get raped, and it sort of becomes this sort of, like, this is what a slut looks like, and therefore I should have a right to dress like this without being raped or without being sexually harassed. But then on the other side, I just feel like that almost misses the entire point of what sexual violence is, and it's not even a thing of you either are or are not a slut, and therefore you experience sexual violence. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, needless to say, it was attended by many people in Bristol who were walking against sexual violence, so if we look at it from that perspective.
That's more positive.
Yeah.
You know, there's other things, I guess. There's Reclaim the Nights and stuff at some point that's going to come
up
as well.
Which doesn't... So. And Reclaim the Night has been going for, what, like 30 or 40 years?
Yeah.
I don't... Like, you know, this slut walk is like 1 year old, and it is this global media phenomenon. And hey, I reckon maybe because women dress like sluts, because we're talking about women's sexuality, even though it's the exact same cause as Reclaim the Night. It's about not blaming women and, you know, blaming people who should be blamed. So we definitely have a binary opposition between Reclaim the Night.
Yes, we do a little bit, don't we? Indeed.
It's a little bit more flashy, I guess, slut walk.
I think it is. It's got more pizzazz.
Anyway.
So there is another thing that's a bit... The government's consultation on squatting ended Wednesday the 5th. So if you're planning on appealing to the Tory government's more compassionate side, it's too late.
You missed your chance.
Yes. And, you wouldn't have had much luck. So,
Did you have a look at the questions?
I didn't. Did you?
Yeah, I did a couple of them. Mm-hmm. There was the squash campaign, which was, like, the pro-squatter...
Mm-hmm.
consultation people,
mm-hmm.
Basically like laid out the whole thing, and it was something like 20 questions or something, and they just highlighted which ones, if you don't have time to do them all, which ones you should do. And just reading through the questions, like I did the thing as part of this online campaign, and just reading through the questions, it's so clearly marketed towards, like they clearly have their minds made up, and in the questions it'll, they're just sort of saying things like, have you ever had, you know, negative experiences with squatters and such and such and such, as mm-hmm. every question is framed in like a negative of, you know, what squatters are and, you know, what they do to houses and all these sorts of things.
Yeah.
Very clear agenda. So, yeah, that was a bit shit.
I wonder if the, how do you say, the medical consultation stuff about the NHS is probably quite similar, then, I guess.
Probably. Yeah. But, yeah, very clearly directed towards homeowners, business owners, people who don't like squatters.
So, like, not poor people who are, like, one paycheck away from being homeless, potentially, the vast majority of people.
Yes, yes, but... Well, time will tell on that. But we'll
Yes, indeed.
Also happening at the moment, we'll talk on what's happening today in London in a moment, but next week, on the 15th, there's, from what I can gather, some sort of global... There wasn't a lot of information, or it was a bit mixed when I was online. There seems to be a bit of a global, like, take to the streets. People have listed, like, spaces in America and Asia and Africa... where people are basically taken to the streets basically around recession and democracy. So there's a thing happening in Hyde Park next week in London and marching to Parliament Square. It's marketed, I'll use that word lightly, as a peaceful protest. So that's the emphasis. But there's so much stuff happening around that. I'll probably be there.
Ooh, you can give us a report back then.
I will.
That sounds good. Of an occupation of a different sort, a quiet country road in Somerset was the setting for a 250-strong blockade this week as activists gathered to oppose the construction of Hinkley C, the first new nuclear power station to be built in the UK for over 20 years. Part of the government's plans for up to 10 in total across the UK, so watch out. It's weird timing as well for that, given everything that's just happened with the tsunami and things, who says there's any way to possibly talk sense to this government? Anyways, for people's information, the project is backed by the French energy company EDF.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay. Shall we move on to global?
Yes, let's do that.
Cool. So in global news, for people who have been watching Saudi Arabia, so there was previously we talked about the right to drive campaign that women were forcing upon people almost driving their cars. This was their action, the right to drive campaign, which resulted in a bunch of arrests, but certainly made a really amazing point. I was just reading the other week that. King Abdullah has said women will have the right to stand and vote in future and local elections and join the advisory council as full members. I've just got a quote here. Because we refuse to marginalise women in society in all roles that comply with Sharia, we have decided after deliberation with our seniors and others to involve women in the council as members starting from next term. Women will be able to run as candidates in the election and will even have the right to vote, he added. So liberal activists in the country have long called for greater rights for women who are barred from travelling, working or having medical operations without the permission of a male relative and are forbidden from driving. Women's rights activists have praised the changes, claiming women's voices will finally be heard. Now it's time to remove other barriers, like not allowing women to drive cars and not being able to function, to live a normal life without male guardians. The Right to Drive campaign is still happening alongside this as well, and the details of arrests, like, I've been trying to find information on the arrests and what's been happening, because it was one main woman who was threatened and then, like, stood down as a result of that. I haven't been able to get a lot of information about what the exact charges were or what the situations were, but the cause is still sort of moving forward. And we were just talking before about, the differences in struggles, how across the world, where, like, I've fully support these campaigns, but, you know, it's like supporting someone to drive a car. That's their action is driving, is their political statement. It's like, yeah, I support driving. I suddenly support driving. Yes, voting. Yeah. I'm going to support voting. Cool. So it's just, you know, it's amazing the differences in struggles. And, you know, obviously, like, the women behind these campaigns are just incredible to be working in those environments where it would just seem impossible to even move in such small ways. To, you know, not have the right to vote is something that, like, you know, when I get in arguments with people about feminism, and they'll talk about how feminism's irrelevant and all this sort of, and it's useless and all this sort of shit, and it's just like, you know, do you have sisters? Like, you know, you realize feminism, like, got women the right to vote. Like, you know, people even forget that once upon a time women, you know, they had to, like, ask or, you know, fight for their right to, like, fucking vote in democracy.
So, bullshit.
Yeah. So that's happening at the moment. So shit is going down. Like, it's amazing. I'm trying to get in more contact with what's happening, so I will update more on that. Yeah.
Sounds great. We look forward to hearing about it. Also, in international news, as people may have heard about, but there hasn't been loads of coverage of it. There was initially sort of, I would say, how do you say, a tacit media blackout about it, potentially. It started back on September 17th when a few dozen protesters tried to pitch tents outside the New York Stock Exchange in the belly of the beast. When they were blocked, they were blocked by the police, and also sort of hundreds camped out opposite the New York Stock Exchange to take their anti-capitalist message basically to the belly of the beast, to the stock exchange, to the American government, to the police, to whoever. And this also relates to a national call to occupy the London Stock Exchange starting on October 15th at 4:30, so be punctual. Yeah. And it's meant to end December 12th at 11 a.m., so be there, be square, I guess. As we were mentioning, this is sort of the start of sort of something quite, you know, it's a global movement where people are sort of, we've seen this happen in Egypt and across North Africa and the Arab world and things, and it's coming to, you know, North America and Europe as well. So it's quite interesting to see where this leads and things. We saw it as well with, we talked a bit about the occupations of squares in Spain as well and Catalonia and all those places. So.
Yeah, yeah. And now's the time to be doing it. Like, you know, too often in the past I've let stuff fly because I felt, I'm too busy, I can't rearrange my things, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if we're talking about the NHS, you know, we're talking about, like, shit that everyone should be fighting for. Like, now is the time to just get on a bus and go to London and support these events. Like, you actually, you know, I think everyone kind of needs to step up and really get into these events. Because, you know, NHS? Like, you know.
Yeah.
Basic fucking human rights we're talking about. Yeah.
It really is. Yeah, because there's also today, there's UK Uncuts has sort of sponsored an action to occupy the Westminster Bridge and block it. There's also, before we got on air, there seemed to be an equivalent media blackout about it where you couldn't find very much information online except for on UK Uncut and Twitter and places like that where you can find information by following UK Uncuts. But none of the major sort of news sources at our time of going to air were sort of reporting about it. I think after the bridge is shut down by a few thousand people, which is what it looks like it's happening, they might talk about traffic problems. We'll get that a bit later.
All the people can get to their business meetings.
And they're occupying the street because of the proposed cuts to the NHS and basically the selling off of the NHS and the, how do you say, the Americanization of it as well. So as people over here hate being love griping on about the United States. It's a bit shameful that I think people are adopting a more American style, or, you know, the country's on its way to adopting a more American style of healthcare and things. So
it
didn't work out very well over there. So
yeah, I know. Why?
What's going on? What are people thinking?
That's all the news.
That's it. Yeah, it's all the news I got at the minute. There's loads more going on, I'm sure.
But it's not all in the world. But we've got Dale Farm now.
We do. We're going to go to a track of music first, aren't we?
Yes, of course. X-Ray Specs. Oh, okay. So in news, I am very late on this, and this is shameful, but in April, polystyrene from the X-Ray Specs died. I don't know who heard this, but this is very devastating. She was awesome.
Tragic.
She wore braces in a punk band. I was just reading before, and like people held that up as some sort of like political statement that she had braces on as a front woman. Like, well, clearly she just needed braces. Like, you know, it wasn't a political statement, but it was like, you know, she was this sort of feminist, like, icon because of her, like, you know, she had, like, really amazing fashion sense and that real, like, I don't give a shit kind of thing. But the fact that the braces keeps coming up, I feel like, well, that was the part that wasn't even intentional.
Yeah.
But anyway, she died, unfortunately. Breast cancer, which spread to her spine. Yeah, so...
Do your checks, women?
Yeah, that's right. Age 53, so she died in April. And yeah, oh. I'm very aware. What are we, October now? But I'm just having a bit of an X-ray specs revival, so I was listening to them the other day and thinking, oh, fuck yeah. And then I found out that she had died this year, so oh well.
Oh, no.
So we are going to play their classic track, O Bondage Up Yours, which she has that great section at the beginning about little girls, which I love. So yeah, we're going to play that now. So enjoy.
Some people think little girls should be seen and not heard, but I think, oh, bondage up yours! 1, 2, 3, 4!
That amazing track from the X-ray specs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So now we're going to go and have we're going to chat about what's going on in Dale Farm, what's happening, get the deal-o. So we're here today with Frodo. Hey.
Hey.
And Pippin.
Hiya.
And Rose.
Hey.
Hey. So and they've all spent a bit of time at Dale Farm. So I was going to begin to ask, it's a bit of a wordy question, but I'm sort of more interested in how things are going for people there. But I thought it was also important to mention that so sort of in 1968, the Caravan Sites Act was passed and to protect the rights and culture of travellers in the UK. But since that time, it's been sort of picked to pieces by things like the Criminal Justice Act in 1994 and the proposed Tory-sponsored localism bill that's coming up. The Traveller Sites grant scheme of 2008, which provided funding to local authorities to create and refurbish sites, which admittedly had limited success, has also been axed by the Tories. So can you talk about the way sort of these changes to laws and things are affecting the community at Dale Farm and other traveller communities within the UK?
Oh, hi. Yeah, so basically these laws over since the 80s have been forcing travellers to sometimes squat sites illegally and sometimes buy lands, but they find it really, really difficult to get planning permission on that land, and essentially more more and more travellers are being forced to go into to live a settled way of life, because life on the road is too hard for them. So people that have been going down to support the travellers at Dale Farm, we essentially think that this is a form of ethnic cleansing.
And for an example of just how biased some of that is, 90% of planning permission requests from travellers are refused, which is far, far higher than it is for any other ethnic group in the country.
That does sound really quite high, definitely. Yeah, it just seems a bit crazy. And I think the localism bill as well, because I think one of the ways that travellers have gotten rights to certain sites is sort of retrospectively. And I think the localism bill is going to squash that, you know, so it's going to get rid of that, you know, that right to do that, that way of doing that, so that will in effect sort of illegalize sort of people's ways of life and things.
Great. And so the local Basildon council has offered to evict the group, has offered the evicted group sort of bricks and mortar accommodation in a number of different areas. And can you tell us a bit about the impact this will have on the community?
I'm not sure there'll be any community if that happens, because what that means is that everyone will be split up. People who spent their whole lives working together and looking after the elderly with each other and looking after their kids won't be looked after anymore and will be stuck in their homes alone. And yeah, I think it's going to completely destroy it.
Great. Pippin?
Not every family or group there has been offered bricks and mortar accommodation. Only a few have been offered this. In fact, a lot of the families were offered the same house, one bedroom bedsit that smelt. A woman with bad legs and bad breathing was offered a flat on the sixth floor of a council estate, isolated and alone. I mean, one of the nicest parts of the community, one of the nicest stories that I heard, this two sisters who have kids were really struggling to get the money together for a car, so the community did a whip round and helped them get a car together. So they can, without that kind of level of support, a lot of the people with children, if the husbands are away travelling, don't get a chance to have that kind of level of freedom. Whereas if they're living together in a community, they can support each other.
Right. Do you have anything to add, Rose?
Yeah, that was one of the most amazing parts about going down to Dale Farm and being welcomed into this community, was what an amazing community it was. Everybody knows everyone, they look after each other's children, they look after their elderly, and that's really amazing. It's not anything I've experienced before. In terms of the bricks and mortar accommodation, a lot of the things that were offered were actually only temporary. There's a place called Arnas Vale in Basildon that was it's a homeless, temporary homeless hostel type place, which has got some bungalows as well. And they were actually, just before the first eviction date, when they thought that was going to go ahead, moving people out of this homeless hostel that had problems finding housing to move travellers, move travellers into it after the eviction, which is appalling, really. I mean, the travellers there, they don't want to go into bricks and mortar. They have beautiful houses, really, you know, lovely caravans and a lovely community. All they're asking for is a piece of land to put them, that they're allowed to live on, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess that sort of gets a bit to the nature of the site that was there that people are talking about. The council seems to have sort of said, oh, this was like greenbelt land and they've and we want to return it to being greenbelt, but effectively it was like a scrapyard that people went to live on and they've made into a home, and now they want to return it to, I don't know what, but basically a place where this tragic thing has happened, you know, so just seems a bit, it's quite skewed.
Yeah, actually the council were the ones who laid down some of that concrete before it was a scrapyard, and they don't actually have the right to remove a lot of this. This is what's holding up in the courts at the moment. Originally, the council thought that they were going to go in there and clear everything. They've admitted that they don't have the right to take some of the fences and walls and actually some of the concrete away. So they said that they'd clear it and put it back afterwards, which of course was ridiculous. And so that's what's kind of holding it up in court at the moment, but they won't be able to do a full eviction now.
Yeah, the legal battle seems quite complicated, but because I think also initially part of the site was bought by a traveller family for, what was it, £122,000 or something, and then, but since then I think there was the first complaints
against some of the travellers. The land was bought in 1996. Some of the complaints happened in about 2001, and now it's 10 years later, and they're trying to evict them at a cost of potentially, what was it? It's a massive cost in things. I think it's £22 million or something. Mm-hmm. So it just seems like it's just quite complicated, and a bit, to an outsider, it just sounds like a bit nuts and things. So I wonder if you could sort of tell us how that sort of legal process is going a bit more. Like you mentioned, sort of they're having trouble and they're having, you know, these kinds of things.
Yeah, well, it seems a bit mad to me that this is being forced through planning courts and not where I think it should be, which is kind of a human rights issue. And so, that of course, every time they've lost in previous court battles because it's planning courts and it's the technicalities.
I guess sort of just the complicated legal process that's going on with the eviction. You mentioned a little bit in terms of like they can evict people, but they have to have certain bits of concrete and certain walls that can remain. Like what's the sort of latest that's going on with that?
I'm not sure exactly what's happened recently.
I think Pippin maybe.
I suppose you can fill me in, Fredo, when I get. But there are 5 plots that are allowed to stay. So there's 2 halves of the site. Half the site have planning permission, half the site don't. That's the part they're trying to evict. Within that site, there are 5 plots that are allowed to stay residential, like with everything on it. Then there's a number of plots along one side that they can't remove. They can't permanently remove the fencing or the hard standing, it's called the concrete. And then there are a number of other plots where one caravan's allowed to stay or one chalet's allowed to stay, but they're allowed to remove the hard standing. I mean, there's this ridiculous story of these 2 women who've grown up together, are best friends, have kids the same age, whose kids go to the same school. They've got the exact same chalets, adjacent, on plots next to each other. One of those women has to leave, one of them has to stay. And they've grown up together, they're best friends. Mm-hmm. And there is a whole... It's just unbelievable. It makes it really clear how ridiculous it is and how arbitrary all the things are. I think that's the latest, I don't know.
Yeah, and I think the fact it's really important to emphasize, yes, it's really complicated, and this is really hurting the families that one day they'll come home and there'll be a rumor going round of something the way they can do to help save the plots, like putting fencing back in, and so there'll be a mad rush to do that. Mm. And it's just making things really frustrating for people when they don't know what's happening or they feel they don't understand it, and every week suddenly they're not being evicted and they can stay a week longer, and it's really hard.
Yeah, that sounds like it would be hard on top of all the sort of just general persecution of their lifestyle and everything as well. So that sounds like it'd be incredibly stressful. And there are some people I've heard that are quite ill that are on site as well, so that are suffering. So it's not good, really. Yeah, I was just wondering, before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to add or where people can go to get more information? And also what kind of solidarity is needed as well, or what kind of requests are being made?
First off, if you want to check updates or find out what's needed, the Dale Farm has a solidarity movement has a blog, which is dalefarm.wordpress.com, and or you can ring the site phone. They've got a mobile, which is 075-836-21312. We're hoping to organise a benefit event in Bristol next week, so check into media for that. Cool. And one of the things that, apart from numbers, of course, that people need is at the moment is money, because it's a lot of people have quit their jobs or aren't getting dole money because they're on the site, and that financial support is very needed if you can't supply anything else.
Cool. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah,
thank
cheers. You. Thank you. It's definitely something we'll keep following as well. So, yeah, thanks a lot.
Cool.
And I guess now we're going to go to a track.
Yeah.
Yes. We'll go to Citizen Fish, Backlash, classic punk rock. They played at this weekend's Subvert Fest. I heard they were amazing. We'll be right back. that was a great track, eh?
Indeed.
Indeed, great. Okay, cool. So we're back with Frodo, because while the song was on, it occurred to us that there was something else to mention about what's coming up this week on Wednesday.
Yeah. On Wednesday is the next court date, and it's quite possible that they could decide to evict after that. And so it's really important that people are ready if there's a call out. However, it's also possible the judge can make a decision to hear a judicial review, which will mean it's delayed for months. And so, yeah, everything's really up in the air, but it's really worth having people ready to go up there if they can.
Great. Okay. Well, everybody will be ready. Bags packed.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. Cheers. Cool. Okay, so next we're going to go to a little piece that we pre-recorded with John Clark about the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty and their work they've been doing for over 10 years to resist basically the cuts and the sort of neoliberal tendencies of the government in Canada. It's quite interesting. They've done lots of stuff, so check it out.
So, hello, and today we're speaking with John Clark from the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. So, hi, John.
Hello, dear.
Hi. And so OCAP's been around for about 10 years now, or a little bit over, and it started while Premier Mike Harris was in power in Ontario, and he launched basically a massive wave of cuts and privatization across the province. It was a major attack against the poor in Ontario and sort of a general period of neoliberal economic policies in Canada as a whole. And can you tell us a bit about how people start to get organized together to sort of fight and resist this agenda?
Yeah. Our organization had actually been around for a while before Harris came to power, but in 95 when he was elected, the nature of the work changed because it was one of those regimes that was devoted to sort of speeding up the pace of the neoliberal agenda. Probably at the provincial level here in Ontario, something quite similar to what Margaret Thatcher did in Britain or Ronald Reagan did in the United States. And so there was a whole series of massive cuts that were implemented in various areas of life. Basic income support for poor and unemployed people was cut by 21.6%. Budgets for the Ministry of Labour, which enabled any kind of employment standards to be enforced, were massively cut. There were cuts in healthcare. There were cuts all across the board. And so people were initially quite shocked by what was taking place, but a number of organizations, including our own, started to organize actions, organize struggles. We organized a march from a very poor area of Toronto into one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in Toronto, to the home of the lieutenant governor, who under the system here represents the Queen, and the man who would be signing the welfare cut into effect. And we organized a march to his house, and those kinds of actions began to spark things. And then the trade unions became involved and organized a series of actions that were known as the Days of Action, which were essentially localized general strikes and mass mobilizations. They were enormously powerful, had great potential, were unfortunately in the end not followed through to a decisive conclusion. But there was large-scale mobilizing throughout the Harris years, a whole series of major strike actions and large-scale community mobilizations. And we were involved in a major demonstration of the homeless at the Ontario Legislative Building that was attacked by the police and led to a confrontation that became known as the Queen's Park Riot, which was one of the major mobilizations and confrontations of the period. So Harris was fought, not, I believe, in the way he could have been decisively in the end, but he was challenged.
Yes, definitely. And sort of over the years, OCAP's developed sort of many strategies for sort of mobilizing and things, and it's different than many other anti-poverty groups. I guess you could say in its quote-unquote toolkit, there are things like direct action caseworks, campaigns for raising the rates, special diets, so to ensure that people on welfare benefits and things actually can eat enough food and eat nutritious food. And all of these are coupled sort of with a very determined philosophy of sort of fighting to win and a commitment to the sort of the long-term struggle. And sort of, can you tell us a bit about how you carry out your work on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, well, a lot of the mobilization that we carry out is indeed around people's individual situations, because we seek to be, in a certain sense, a union of poor people. And so that means that we that we can't just organise around the broader issues. We have to be able to show that we can intervene and make a difference in people's lives at the immediate point of attack that affects them. So if people are denied assistance, denied income support, we may organise a mass delegation that goes to the social assistance office and challenges that decision. We may organise to challenge an eviction, to challenge a deportation from the country, those kinds of things. And that's the basic component, I suppose, of the work that we do. And then beyond that, given that we've been facing this incredible proliferation of poverty and regressive social cutbacks, we've also organised major broader campaigns. The special diet that you refer to is a particular provision that exists within the legislation here that enables people to get additional income if a medical provider deemed it necessary. So we organised large-scale hunger clinics where sympathetic medical providers would sign people up for the special diet, and it became a major campaign. We got actually hundreds of millions of dollars to people through the campaign, and the point about it was that the welfare bureaucracies would do everything they could to deny people assistance, and so it wasn't just a simple process of getting people to come to clinics and signing them up. People then had to be prepared to mobilise and fight for the things that they were asking for, and so it became an incredible mobilising tool. This city, Toronto, is one of the, according to the United Nations, one of the most multicultural cities on earth. And so the mobilisation that took place in immigrant communities was especially important, especially significant. The leading edge of the special diet campaign was the Somali community in the west end of the city, and the work around the special diet led to larger scale mobilising and the building of a base that didn't just deal with special diet issues, but dealt with issues of police and security company harassment, dealt with immigration issues, deportations, a whole range of issues, and so the special diet campaign had the effect of increasing the level of mobilisation. And at this point in time, we're starting to build a level of cooperation with a number of major trade unions, including the Ontario Nurses Association and the Canadian Union of Public Employees, which would be the closest thing to Unison that exists in this country, and that's enormously exciting and important as well. A lot of union activists and locals getting involved in the campaign.
Yeah, definitely. So sort of over the years, OCAP's made a few enemies, I'm sure, but also made a lot more friends along the way. And can you tell us about some of the allies you've made and how you've linked the struggle against poverty to other struggles against oppression?
Yeah, we built quite a number of different allies. There's a lot of community-based mobilising that's taking place in this city. We have a close working alliance with a number of different committees and organisations of poor people that exist in this city and in different parts of the province of Ontario. We have a very close working relationship with an organisation called No One Is Illegal, which organises around people without status who exist in this, without legal status to live here, who exist by the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands in this city. We've built a working relationship with active local unions and organisations within the labour movement, activists within the labour movement who are interested in getting away from the sort of the conservative lobbying approach that seems to dominate so much of the labour movement here. We've had a good working relationship over the years, particularly with the Canadian Union of Postal Workers. They've done a great deal to support us. We've done a great deal to support them. On one occasion, a number of their workers were victimised in a particular plant, and we organised with them something called a boss-free day, where we set up a picket line that allowed the workers and the customers of Canada Post to come in, but didn't allow any supervisors or management staff in the building, and the place operated without any supervisory staff the whole day. It would be completely wrong in the context of Canada as well to fail to take notice of the fact that that this country was built on land that was taken from Indigenous people, and it's as an anti-poverty organisation, as a progressive organisation, we've found it enormously important to build a working relationship with First Nation people and their organisations, and have had a wonderful working relationship with a whole series of different people and initiatives within the First Nations communities, most particularly people who are members of the Mohawk Nation, whose actions and struggles we've supported, and who've done the most incredible work of assisting us and working with us, and on many occasions have gone out and brought the food that was served up at major rallies and demonstrations that we've held. So those are some of the sort of areas where we've sought to build an alliance. We do see ourselves, we do see the question of mobilising a poor people's movement as very important, but we also see it as part of a broader working class mobilisation that must take place if we're going to turn back this post 2008 crisis hyper neoliberalism that we're now dealing with, and that you're certainly dealing with over there.
Hello, and now we're back. We're back with Boris himself from the Bristol Anarchist Federation. Hey.
Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing all right.
Good stuff.
Hanging a bit from Subvert.
Didn't know you liked that kind of music, Boris. But, you know, takes all types, doesn't it? So I was wondering, I guess we just heard that interview by John Clark as well a bit earlier about the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty and some of the work they've been doing over there against the cuts for about over a decade. And there's work that's been started over here as well against the cuts. And I was wondering if you could tell us just generally about how things have been going locally as well, making the links, I guess. And
yeah, sure. I mean, we've had a lot going on locally in loads of different spheres. At the moment, it's really being led by what the council are trying to do in Bristol that's affecting how people are organising. The biggest cuts that the council is bringing in at the moment are cuts to people's social care and healthcare. Primarily, it's they're closing 10 of 12 residential care homes in Bristol. They're also completely scrapping the home care team, the people that actually go out to people's houses, with plans to fully privatise that service. The biggest cut at the moment is probably the cuts to voluntary organisations. About 26 voluntary organisations in Bristol are losing their funding, and they run things like day centres for the elderly. For some people, this is the only chance they get to get out of the house and actually socialise with people. So the scrapping of these centres will really affect people's quality of life. And for some people, it could be really detrimental to their health because they're not getting the support that they need. The council is planning to replace this with what it calls like personal choice, where they give each individual old person a budget and they have to choose how it's spent on private companies. In effect, this is just an excuse to make cuts not seem like cuts, make them seem like their freedom and choice, when actually it's just going to mean a lot less options and a lot less care for elderly people. The response to this has really started to kick off at the moment, though. We've got people have been organising within the day centres. So they've been chatting to the people that use the day centres and to the staff there, and they've got a really good response. And in fact, one of the day centres, Trinity Day Centre, has kicked up enough of the fuss that they're getting a counsellor that's going to attend and speak to them about their grievances. They also have plans for further protests and action. And we think it's really important that people make direct links with the people that are being hardest affected by the cuts. Another group of people that are organising at the moment, it's a group called the Hardest Hit Coalition. It's a coalition of disabled people from a variety of groups, and they're coming together to try and prevent the cuts and changes to disability benefit, which they say will have a really negative impact on a lot of people's lives. And they're actually organising marches all the way across the country on the 22nd of October. And for the southwest area, the march is going to be in Bristol and College Green. So if anyone wants to get involved in that, they can go to College Green, 12 p.m. on Saturday the 22nd. They're looking for people to help out stewarding as well. So anyone that thinks they can put on a brightly coloured blib should turn up a couple hours early and lend a hand with that.
That's great. So it sounds like there's lots of stuff that's been going on and people have sort of been trying to work with those who are most affected by the cuts and things. I think at the Tory party convention, we saw David Cameron apologise to women as well for sort of just not being very good with women, not being very receptive or understanding. And I think also just that cuts as well tend to affect women and children as well quite a bit, disproportionately as well, like as one of those groups that are quite affected by these kinds of things. I think sort of unemployment rates and things like that reflect these kinds of changes and possibilities of work when you have less support and things like that as well from the state. So, and how have you found it as a sort of an anarchist federation organising around cuts issues? How have you found links and what kind of allies have you been making along the way?
I think initially a lot of people were mostly surprised and confused by the fact there were anarchists and anti-cuts meeting. Mm-hmm. The general argument being, you're anarchists, you don't like the state, they're cutting the state, surely that's a good thing. We've had a lot of discussions with people and actually ended up printing a frequently asked questions to hand out to our potential allies at the larger anti-cuts meetings in Bristol. And now that's been put to rest and we've been able to sort of work with groups more and they kind of understand where we're coming from, that, you know, we see the cuts as an attack on the working class and we need to respond to it as such. And the fact that the cuts the state is planning to make doesn't actually give us any more freedom, it doesn't abolish hierarchy, all it does is make the poor and vulnerable worse off. The allies we have now started to make, as well as obviously the people that are being most affected by the cuts, have included groups we never really thought we'd end up working with, including sort of mainstream trade unions and the bureaucrats within them, and also sort of broader leftist groups. Mm-hmm. But also a lot of less political community organisations have started to get involved, and I think that's probably where the key is. I mean, if the anti-cuts fight is just going to mobilise, you know, the same 1% of people that refer to themselves as socialists and anarchists and communists, then it's not going to win. It needs to get more people involved, and I think that's really started to happen, and I think it's really important that that continues. Mm-hmm. There are the big Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance meetings that tend to be a bit tedious at times, but they're sort of worth enduring to sort of really get to grips with a whole different sections of society that we don't normally as anarchists associate with.
Which is good as well, really. Yeah.
I mean, we need to get our message out and also support other people in their struggles as much as we can.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's good to be making those links and things and sort of I guess just sort of communicating with talking to different communities and sort of taking on board people's concerns and, you know, working in struggle with other people, definitely. And can you tell us a bit about some of the actions that have gone on in the past around Bristol, around sort of UK, around Bristol Uncuts sort of stuff and the sort of some of the tax dodgers and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, earlier in this year and at the end of last year, there are quite a few UK Uncut actions in Bristol. The first few were organised by the Anarchist Federation, but we made an active attempt to avoid making it sectarian, so people that weren't anarchists were comfortable coming along and didn't feel that they were under our banner, and we didn't force them to buy any newspapers or anything like that.
Phew.
they were really successful in sort of the numbers of people that came along. Some of them had sort of 60, 70 people attending, and shut down stores all the way across Bristol and got quite a lot of media coverage and quite a lot of people stopping and talking to us. Obviously quite a lot of negative people that really, really needed to buy that particular shirt in Topshop, but the majority of people, once we explained what we were doing, were relatively on side or had heard about UK Uncut before. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of actions have trailed off in Bristol and across the country, I think largely because they are mainly symbolic actions, although mm-hmm. they do have some economic impact mm-hmm. on the companies. Obviously we recognise it's not going to be enough to get change on its own. I think the important thing about those actions were getting the argument in the sort of public consciousness that the cuts aren't necessary because there's lots of money. The problem is all the money is in the hands of quite a few people who don't want to give it to anyone else. Mm-hmm. Now that point's kind of started to get across, I think it's important to change tactics rather than just becoming mm-hmm. repetitive and doing the same old thing again and again.
Indeed, yeah. I think the protesters in Wall Street make a good point when they say we are the 99%. There's only sort of 1% or probably less than that that are the uber rich that benefit from any of the way that the capitalist system works, or that, you know, these tax dodging ways and things. So, or it's probably more than 1% that benefit from that. But, you know, that are the uber rich and that are the tax dodgers. And really, it's the rest of us that are suffering from these things. So, yeah, it's quite interesting. And I think it's been sort of portrayed that the UK has been quite slow to sort of fight some of these cuts and things, but from what you're saying, people have been sort of fighting them, and the movement's definitely sort of growing against them, and I guess the bigger solidarity seems to be growing as well, which is quite good.
Yeah, I think compared to a lot of countries in Europe, it seems that the UK has been very slow to react.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of that is just the culture that we have in the UK. Obviously in countries like France, it's quite common for people to get out on streets en masse, but in the UK, we hadn't really had a large-scale set of protests since the outbreak of the Iraq War. And it's, March 26 was quite huge, and I think showed that there are people out there that do care enough to, at the very least, get on a coach to London for the day. I think the next big thing is going to be the strike on November the 30th.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of public sector and hopefully a couple of private sector unions as well that are balloting for strike action. It's been referred to as a general public sector strike for one day. They're hoping to close down the majority, if not all, of the public sector workplaces.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's really important that some private sector unions do get involved in this as well.
Mm-hmm.
As one of the main divisions the coalition government's trying to make is between public and private sector workers. And I think it's, you know, our strength is that, you know, we are the 99%.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of us, and if we work together, we can win this one. Whereas if we're split off into little groups and they manage to turn public sector against private sector and the employed against the retired and things like that, I think the anti-cuts movement will fall apart.
Indeed.
But so far, it's maintained quite a good amount of strength. We're worried after March 26th that as anarchists, we're going to get a lot of flack from the unions and from the more moderate groups regarding the sort of smashing of windows and such that took place after the march. But mm-hmm. Generally people were pretty on side, and I think it's a real change to maybe more of a more European protest culture, where unions and other groups and the general public are realizing that direct action and more militant tactics do have a place within protest movements.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly because of the failure of more completely standard and protests like the A to B marches for the Iraq War, against the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you want to add, or any you know, websites people should be checking out to so they can get more involved or to keep up to date with all the news and things like that?
If you want to get involved, the Badica meetings, the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance meetings, can be a good place to start. It's important to understand that the chats afterwards can be nearly as important as the meetings themselves, which, as I said, can be a bit tedious, but definitely worth enduring. And they're the first Monday of every month. I believe the next one is November the 7th at 7:30 at the Friends Meeting House, the Quaker Place near Cabot Circus.
Oh, yeah.
If you get down there if you're interested in getting involved, or you can contact the Anarchist Federation and ask about what's coming up. We've got an email address, bristol@afed.org.uk.
Great.
And if you search Bristol Anarchist Federation, you should come up with our WordPress page as well.
Mm-hmm.
The big thing to look out for is definitely going to be the November 30th strike action. There's going to be a big march planned in Bristol, but it's hoped that lots of smaller groups will do interesting actions on the periphery and before and after the march as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that has the sort of support of a lot of people that are involved in the Anti-Cuts Alliance, although obviously maybe not the top bureaucrats in the unions and such.
Yeah.
There's also some student actions coming up at the beginning of November. On the 4th of November, there's been a national student walkout called, and it's hoped there's going to be a meet-up between the two universities and also some of the colleges and sixth forms around Bristol for a big protest in the centre. And then on November the 9th, there's a big demo in London to sort of reignite the students after their long summer break. So there should be quite potential for that to be a bigger, noisy and interesting demo in London.
Sounds good. So definitely a lot to keep people's calendars busy and full. Great. Well, thanks a lot for speaking to us today, Boris.
No problem. Back to London for me.
On your bike, I guess. I feel like I want to make some joke about that. great. Cheers. Thanks a lot. So now we're going to go to another track.
Bit of a lowdown on what's happening with the squatting law that's being proposed at the moment. So, as we mentioned before, the consultation date closed on the 5th of October, which was this sort of pissy questionnaire that, you know, was supposed to inform the decision, but yeah, we'll find out whether that's the case. Basically, it was sort of, the consultation was put forward to, this is the quote, to strengthen the law on squatting to protect vulnerable and weak business and homeowners. Like, I didn't even write that. That's not even sarcastic. Vulnerable and weak business and homeowners. The sort of top knobhead who's doing this is Crispin Blunt. He's said, far too many people have had to endure the misery, expense and incredible hassle of removing squatters from their property. Hard-working home and business owners need and deserve a justice system where their rights come first. Really, I think the point is, if people / faceless bureaucracies didn't own so many properties, then there wouldn't be so much hassle in removing squatters in the first place. Mm-hmm. But, you know, old Crispin, he's just doing his job, so
yeah.
We'll see. At present, squatting isn't illegal. It's treated as a civil matter and dealt with in civil courts. So as long as somebody can prove ownership and right to possession, they can get a possession order and get people evicted. So it's not really that much of a process. At present, what the government is trying to do is make squatting illegal. So the proposals in the consultation include making squatting a criminal offence with a prison sentence for persistent squatters and abolishing squatter rights, allowing owners to re-enter by force. So the proposed new law effectively removes Section 6 of the Criminal Law Act, making squatting a criminal act of trespass. So obviously, if we move past the whole greedy property, you know, all these buildings are mine and no one can touch them at all, we can, but like, you know, it doesn't take a genius to realise that the majority of these empty buildings are owned by large corporations. They're being repossessed by banks, they're offshore companies, government departments, etc., etc. And it's not necessarily private individuals here. We're talking about, there's not even a human, like, they're written on a list somewhere. And these buildings are being left to rot. And what the government is doing and what this law is trying to do is protect empty buildings which are largely like gutted or derelict. They're protecting these buildings, which become an eyesore to communities, and at the end of the day could be used for neighbourhood projects and housing, which I think is the main point. That's what the country is in desperate need of. I don't know if you've been following the media about the hardworking individuals being affected, family homes that are being taken away. There just seems to be some really beautiful articles about like people leaving on holiday and, you know, they come back and someone's drinking their wine and changing the locks on their house and all this sort of stuff. Have you read anything?
I haven't, but I could only just imagine what gets printed in things like the Tory Graph and things about, about squatters and squatting.
Yeah, well, that's the main thing that the media is running with, that there's that fear of like people's actual homes are being squatted, that's what the issue is. And that's why the proposal is taking place, because we're trying to protect families and we're trying to protect private homeowners. But no one in their right mind would ever do that. Like, I did a bit of research, and apparently no one's house has been squatted, like, as in that's where they live, not their summer house or whatever. No one's house has been squatted in over 40 years, and that there was a law introduced in 1977 to stop this happening, that you can legally reclaim your home immediately.
So they're full of beans.
Yeah, like, it's absurd. Why would you even do that? Obviously, squatting is about trying to find the best possible place that you could stay on. Like, you know, you obviously know at some point that you're going to be evicted, so you want to stay for as long as possible. You wouldn't squat someone's house. This is just absurd. So I just see that as a wider sort of scare campaign. So it's, you know, not only is there just that downright rude kind of notion of, like, the unwashed squatter, like, you know, crusty punk kind of thing, but now there's this insane notion that they're going around stealing people's houses, that's what's actually happening, which obviously isn't what's happening. So I think with this, you know, it's important to remember that there's a legal right, you know, people have legal rights, and then people also have moral rights, and I feel like this is, like, the crossover point. Like, I was at the courthouse the other week, and it's such, you know, it's so common for people to say, yeah, well, you don't have a legal right to be there, do you? And I just feel like, how can you not even be aware that what you're actually defending is just an empty building?
Well, it's the entrenchment of the idea of private property further, as we, like, with the Tory government, with, you know, those kinds of things, that private property is, you know, this sacred thing that we can't ever attack and we can't touch and we can't question even, especially, like, that, you know, there was common land here, there is common land, you know, and things, and it's just, you know, and squatting is still legal, but not for much longer, you know, and those kinds of things. But people, they don't get that, and these ideas become so deeply entrenched, and people internalize this messed up stuff.
Yeah, these crackers who read the Daily Mail, I don't know. Yeah, I know, we need more positive stuff, but, like, obviously it's the mainstream press which is the issue, and I've been reading report backs from different anarchist meetings about, you know, how the, like, what the campaign's going to be sort of focusing on in the future, like, because now the consultation's done, it's sort of, they're looking at, like, next year, you know, that people will start to actually think about whether the law's going to change and whatnot. In relation to, like, the media, a lot of the anarchist report backs that I've read have been people just talking about, you know, not even really even concerning themselves with trying to get mainstream press on side, because it just seems like, you know, these stories are just being produced out of thin air.
Yeah.
About, you know, and it sort of is also sidelined with this anti-immigration thing as well. I've read a couple that have been like, Polish family takes over English summer house and things like that, where it's, you know, these immigrants of all people like come in and then they eat your food and all this sort of stuff. So that's essentially what's happening. And when I go to the BAM meeting every now and then, which is Bristol Housing Action Movement, like, squatter meeting that happens every Monday. When I was there, I met a journalist called Will who writes for The Spark, and he was trying to do a positive, like, squatter spin for the Spark magazine. Yeah, we'll go to that interview now with Will from the Spark magazine. Cool. Explain in simple terms what the proposed legislation is about and why the government would be introducing it.
Well, I mean, my own personal opinion of why the government is introducing it, I mean, I think politically, this is a way to appease the right wing of the Conservative Party, which has not completely got to grips with the fact that it's actually in a coalition with the Liberal Democrats. And this is a little bit of legislation that they can throw to the right wing to prove that they're the good old Conservative Party that they used to be. Yeah. In other words, they're coming down tough upon sections of society which they feel I don't see their visions really. I mean, squatters are easy targets, I think, really.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly what I was going to say, yep.
And there's no real, there's no pressing reason to do this. It's not a, the number of people who are squatting in Great Britain is actually quite small.
Yeah.
But what we do have a massive homeless problem. We have 700,000 empty properties in the UK. And we have a situation with housing at the moment whereby, I mean, building private housing has ground to a halt because of the recession. There's
yeah.
no public housing that is really being built at the moment. So we have a problem with homelessness as it is at the moment anyway. As far as we can see, the proposals will just make this worse.
Yeah. And are you able to just, like, in simple terms, explain exactly what they're going to change from the existing laws, like what they're proposing to change?
Yeah. I mean, at the moment, it's a consultation document. The consultation ended, I think, about a week ago. So I guess the full proposals will be put into a white paper pretty soon. But in a nutshell, a consultation set out a number of proposals, but the most important of which is that it turns squatting from a criminal, from a civil offence into a criminal offence. The difference is that it's traditionally been a civil offence whereby it's an unlawful practice, but it's not illegal. So in other words, it's a matter for the civil courts instead of the criminal courts. You're committing
yeah.
offence against the owner rather than the state. So
yeah.
In those circumstances, the owner has to go to the courts and then take out and that's to try and get squatters out that way. Under the proposals, it will begin to convert into a criminal offence whereby the police can just come around and arrest squatters
yeah.
just like that. Previously, the only criminal offence you'd be doing as a squatter is if you cause damage by gaining entry. And, of course, if you manage to get into the property without causing damage, then that's fine, really. So you're not committing a criminal offence. So that's the crucial difference. And
yeah, exactly.
Obviously, it drags the police into the equation in a way that they previously haven't been. It probably gives them a lot more workload as well.
Yeah. And so with your research that you've been doing, what's your impression of what the public opinion is at the moment in relation to the proposal?
Public opinion is a funny one, because I think the problem is I think squatting has got a really, really bad image in the UK at the moment.
Yeah.
And you say the word squatters or squatting to those people on the street, the average man or woman in the street, and the whole list of assumptions crop up, really. People think the squatters are, you know, dirty and unclean. They think squatters are simply there just to wreck places.
Yeah.
In the course of doing the research of this article, for a start, I mean, I found that most squatters actually gather a way to make their homes, do their homes up and to make them as nice a place to live as possible. So, yeah, it's got a bad public image, I'd say. And I think, again, that makes it an easy target, I think, for government legislation. I think what might happen, though, if a strong enough campaign is running against this, and I think public opinion could turn,
yeah.
there's definite potential to do that. So I think it's up to even the Scottish movement to actually try and make those links, with, especially the mainstream press.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
A positive view of squatting in there, I think, because I think once the public, once you explain to them that this is actually going to make homelessness worse. It takes away, you know,
yeah.
the DIY solution to homelessness that's been used for decades, even centuries in this country. Once you explain to the public about this, and I think there's potential there for public opinion to change.
Yeah. Do you feel like the mainstream press could come around and actually show squatters in a positive light? Do you feel like that is actually possible? Because there's so much, like, in the news stories that I've been reading, it just seems like
you know, it's so incredibly over the top with what people, like their perceptions and what they're saying about squatters, and I don't know who these people are and who they live next door to, but like, you know, I don't know anyone who acts in the way that the squatters, or supposed squatters in the papers are doing. Do you feel like it could ever fully turn around, that the mainstream press could ever be on the squatters' side?
I think so, yeah, because I think, like I said, there's definitely potential there, but I think, you know, people like yourself and squatters, you know, squatters' movement have to meet the media halfway and try and present an image that isn't quite so scary, because I think squatters are kind of they're just one up from travellers, really.
Yeah.
You know, travellers have got an equally very poor image in the eyes of the mainstream media. The other thing to point out, of course, the other great myth in all this, which is perpetuated in the mainstream media over and over, is that if you're a property owner, then you stand a chance of your own property being squatted if you, say, go on holiday, or if you leave your property empty.
Exactly. Which is absurd.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think, that's sort of the main opinion that's really driving this campaign. It's sort of that sort of be afraid of the unknown, your house is next on the squatter list kind of thing, you know, go get milk from the corner store and you'll come back and someone will have changed the locks and be calling the cops on you kind of thing. What do you think would be the outcome of the law if it did indeed go through?
Well, I mean, the several outcomes. I mean, for one thing, I think it remains to be seen really whether it actually does help squatting, really. Police have got quite a lot on their hands as it is already, but they're facing unprecedented cuts to their budgets in the next few years.
Yeah.
Do they really need the hassle of trying to prosecute and bust squats as well as everything else? I think that remains to be seen. I mean, it might well just be not make much difference in the short term and the long term as well.
Yeah.
So that, I think, the jury's still out on that. I mean, of course, the other thing to bear in mind is the potential for civil unrest as well if they do come down on
hard.
I mean, especially in Bristol, we saw earlier this year, Stokescroft riot was a direct result of a bust on a squat. I think it's going to cause a lot more homelessness, I think. So it's not good for anyone, really, this law, and I think.
Yeah. You know, exactly.
We've got to try and stop it before it does become legislation. And the potential is still there, because I think this government is still, I think it's very open to changing the public opinion. It's already backtracked on a number of things that it proposed. The sell-off the forests, I think, is one thing. The NHS legislation has been cut back considerably. So there is potential there to affect the government on this, I think. But the other thing to bear in mind, of course, is the law could possibly criminalise other things as well. I mean, student sit-ins, the right to protest as well, I mean, encampments, say, climate camp, even traveller encampments. They would all be made illegal under this, because it's trespass, which is essentially what it is, would be made a criminal act. So, there's a lot to fight against on this. So.
Yeah, that's right. It's definitely a holistic legislation. It's not something that's strictly affected. Dirty squatters move into my street with their nonsensical tagas, dirty feet, the dogs, cats, the lyrical elite. They may have bets, but they don't do shit. Furnishing their houses from the context of skits. Things like decent people, but on rubbish tits. They look quite harmless sitting out in the sun. Thank you.
Okay, cool. So that last track was called Dirty Squatter by Zounds, which is a really cool track from an old 70s British band, which I think everyone should be a fan of. Classic. Then they're still touring, apparently. Anyway, so up next we have...
Yeah, we have an interview with Lois. She's from the Kainai Nation in Manitoba in quote-unquote Canada. She was part of an anti-fracking blockade that happened just a little while ago. So she talks to us about the blockade, about the tar sands, the horrible tar sands that they are, and other bits and pieces about sort of native resistance and things and environmentalism within the Americas and things. So it's quite interesting. And the full interview will be posted up on Radio for All, radioforall.net, and the 4 is a number 4, or also on our website as well. So check it out. And here we go.
So hi. Today we're speaking with Lois Frank from the Kainai Nation, the Blood Tribe, and they're based in southern Alberta, Canada. So hi, Lois.
Hi. How are you? How's everything in the UK?
Oh, I'm good, thanks. The sun's come out a little bit today, which is nice. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good, yeah. Just we're harvesting in this area, you know, our crops, and so it's a good time.
Oh, that's wonderful. That does sound like a good time indeed. I'm glad to hear you're doing well. I wanted to ask you a bit about sort of the blockade that happened in your area on September 9th. A group of women from the Kainai Nation, the Blood Tribe, in southern Alberta in Canada, they blockaded the fracking development of a site owned by the U.S. corporation. It's Murphy Oil. Can you tell us what happened and why people blockaded the site?
Well, I'm part of a group of people in southern Alberta called Kainai Earth Watch. And our reserve is the largest in Canada, and as far as land base, and we have a population of about 10,000. And in Canada, you know, a lot of the lands are owned by the Crown, and our reservations in the U.S. and reserves, what they refer to in Canada, are all sort of tribally owned. One of the things that we saw over the past year, since last September, some of our tribal leaders signed agreements with the big oil companies. I think there's, you know, a number of them, Murphy Oil, Bowood, NARP in the U.S., which is Native American Resource Partnerships, and Quantum Resources. There's a number of these agreements. And the people were not consulted about these agreements. They were not given a chance to vote if they even wanted all this development in the community. So, we, you know, that was one of the issues we had because, I mean, the practices that they're going to be using are very detrimental to the environment, to the people, the health of the people. I don't know if you know much about hydraulic fracturing, what they call fracking. It involves shooting fresh water, which sometimes, you know, for one frack, it takes about 4 to 9 million gallons of fresh water, injecting it into the ground with sand and chemicals. And they break up the shale, and the natural gas is released. So it's very dangerous to our water supplies. And these chemicals have been known to be very cancer-causing. you know, we've seen a lot of the health effects, and the problem with the fracking is that these chemicals are seeping into the water supplies of communities, and to the point where some people can actually light their taps on fire because of the gases in the water. So it's very, very dangerous, very toxic, and the practice began in the U.S., you know, when they were experimenting with this, and they want to do this all over the world. It's not just North America, because in Canada and the U.S., the U.S. in particular does not want to be dependent on foreign oil, so they're looking, you know, at developing some of these resources. We in Alberta are faced with the, you know, the tar sands, and major polluter, and they want to build a Keystone pipeline from Alberta into the U.S. to supply, you know, a lot of the oil and gas. And so the people, without regard to what this is going to do to the health of the people or the environment, there's been a number of oil spills. So, you know, our group, because it's happening 8 miles from me, there's one well site there, you know, it's too close to home. There's all kinds of scientific evidence that this is very unsafe. I've never come across anything that's peer-reviewed scientific information that says this fracking is safe. A lot of the people in our community have no knowledge about these agreements. They have had no input, no referendum, no vote. And they're huge. There's three already that have come up in the past summer, and they're slated to put about 200 of these in our community. It's going to be a wasteland because they're going to totally pollute, you know, the environment, the water supplies. And the leaders did it, you know, because they were given, you know, promises of all this oil money. And we, in our community, we've got a lot of people that are with our group, highly educated professors, scientists. You know, a lot of the women that were blockading are very well educated. I'm a doctoral student, and I know I've been working on this for a while, and they're disregarding us. A lot of our leaders sold us out, our chief and council. There were only two councillors who opposed it, but the rest of them, you know, they wouldn't listen to the people. They didn't have any say into what was happening here, and they sold out not only the people, but the land, because we believe that the earth has rights, and it's not just property. So, you know, as stewards, the Indians are the stewards, supposedly the stewards of the land. We're here first, you know, and we have a duty to protect the earth. But what's happening is in our communities, we're seeing a corporatization of our First Nations community, because people have lost sight of what's important. And we, as the Kainai Earth Watch, this is why we protested and we blocked some of those fracking trucks, because there were some spills on the road already, and they've just begun. And we wanted to know, what kind of chemicals are you taking in and out of our community? In the U.S., New York State did this study of what the fracking materials, and I think that's one of the biggest concerns we have. What kind of chemicals are you going to be using? And New York State, there was a moratorium put on banning fracking until they had more information, and they identified some 257 chemicals, I believe, that are involved. They're what they add to, you know, in this fracking, not just the sand and the water. They use all kinds of chemicals, diesel fuel, benzene, formaldehyde. Some, in fact, New York State Department of Environmental Conservation listed about 257 additives that may be mixed with the water and injected into the fracking. And they provided a breakdown of these known chemicals that, you know, was 10 pages long. So it's very, we work closely with the director of Gasland, Josh Fox, who has been raising awareness, and he, you know, did a documentary. I believe it was nominated for an Oscar, and he's one of our adopted tribal members, and he's been, you know, one of the people that, you know, we've been working with. But we've been at this for over a year, and our counselors did not listen to us. They just ignored us. But this is highly toxic, very dangerous, and unless people speak up, it will happen all over, you know, First Nations communities. I'm getting calls from all over the world, you know, that this is happening in their communities, and nobody really knew about fracking. But, you know, the awareness is growing. There's a lot of people that are, you know, against the development of that Keystone Pipeline from Alberta, which is the province we live in, into the U.S. And it's the tar sands is one of the most crude, dirty forms of oil, you know, that is produced, and it could be the number one polluter in the world as far as these greenhouse gas emissions. So there's a reason, as a people globally, we all have to be concerned. We're a global family, and we cannot, you know, be contributing to our own demise and polluting the earth, which gives us life.
Great. So that was Lois. She's quite inspirational as a woman, quite cool. And so now we're going to go to Breaking Away. It's a track by Pettibone, who are an all-female punk band. They played at the recent Subvert Fest this past weekend, last night, in fact. I think they're from London. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
I didn't ask them if they're all British, but they could very well be. Indeed, so we'll go to a track by them. Okay, so we're back, and that was Pettibone. So they were amazing, of course. Indeed, they played at Subvert, and Subvert was also quite good this weekend, so that was great to check out if you're into punk and stuff. You know, it was quite good. One thing that we haven't mentioned that's quite important to mention is that the Factory Social Centre, we interviewed them, I think, on one of our first shows. They're facing eviction at the minute, which they are planning on resisting. So they put a statement out on Bristol Indie Media, so check it out. And I think they're getting solidarity from groups around Bristol and things and other social centres across the UK, I'm sure, as well. Also, I think given that we're part of Cabale and things, just to mention some of the things that go on here at Cabale, which are super cool, is that we're sat in the super cool library, which is a lending library, and you can borrow books. There's also the really super cool info shop downstairs, which is fantastic, and there's loads of good books for you to buy and bring home, and also other bits and pieces.
Lots of zines as well.
Mm-hmm, t-shirts and menstrual pads, reusable menstrual pads, that is, and other bits and pieces. There's also the super cool bike workshop. That's great.
Wednesdays from midday, every Wednesday, midday, bring your bike.
Yeah, indeed. There's the family group. There's permaculture. There's all kinds of other bits and pieces. The art room, the healing room. And there's also, as well, the wonderful cafe full of yummy vegan
of course,
food.
The cafe. Yes. Do come along. Always needing cooks, so come along to cafe Saturday morning or Sunday nights. So
yeah, and Radio Cabale needs volunteers
as
well.
Yes, and most importantly, we need volunteers, yes. So get in contact at, what's our address?
Radio Cabale@riseup.net.
And, cool.
Keep in touch.
Awesome. I think that's everything.
That is.
Sweet. So we'll end on a track, because I'm feeling very feisty around the sort of squatting laws, and I'm just getting need to vent anger outwards. This is why I want to get back on the protests and the demos. So going to London, damn it. So I have selected Dead Kennedys' Lynch Your Landlord. So I'm going to advise that. So here's the track. Enjoy, and we'll see you next time.
Cool.
See you on Thursday. Yes.
Nice. Cool.